Something of a staccato episode this time, with, yes, of course, a bit of Ukraine, but also some stuff which won't be about Ukraine, believe it or not. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. So, I'm recording this on the morning of Monday the 14th of February, as we all wait to see whether or not Putin has a Valentine's Day message for us, or a Valentine's Day massacre. There were overheated claims that this weekend was going to see the start of some massive attack on Ukraine. Well, fortunately that hasn't happened. The otherwise consensus seems to be that this Wednesday seems to be the day that Putin has decided is going to be vremyacha, 0 hour as the Russians would have it. Well, who knows? We'll just have to wait and see. And frankly, even if Wednesday passes without incident, that doesn't necessarily mean that nothing's going to happen. We definitely seem to be in the area in which, if we are to believe all the news from our intelligence services and our political leaderships, we're actually, if not, you know, say a final decision has been made, a provisional decision seems to have been made for a massive escalation. Now, what do I think? Honestly, I don't know. How can I possibly know? How can any of us possibly know, to be perfectly honest? Because even if, yes, there are detailed battle plans and so forth, right up to the 11th hour and the 59th minute, Putin can still choose not to pull the trigger. So, in a way, this is the situation we're in. Unsatisfying as it is, particularly because the world of the pundit is one that privileges absolute confidence and the will and capacity to basically slam down on anyone who challenges your own analytic perspective. But nonetheless, let's just be a little bit humble here and recognise what we don't know. What I will do is just, you know, raise a few little points before, with great relief, moving off the subject of Ukraine. First of all, I mean, I think it's quite interesting that something I mentioned in the context of a previous monologue about the possibility of Moscow deciding as a fallback position to recognise the Donbass and Luhansk pseudo-states, quickly sign some kind of accord which would allow Russian quote-unquote peacekeepers to move in. It would be a failure in many ways of Russian policy. It would be the final surrender on the issue of Minsk, and the opportunity that that may give for leverage within Ukraine. But nonetheless, it would be something, it would be doing something, and it wouldn't be as disastrous as any sort of major military escalation. And at the time, I wondered if part of the reason why we were seeing this being raised by not just pundits and observers, but also in the Duma, the Russian parliament, by United Russia, as well as by the Communist Party, is that it could be, in some ways, an attempt to present Putin with an off-ramp by people within the system who are uncomfortable with the way things are going. We've seen since then a few more signs of that kind of discomfort amongst insiders. An open letter from General retired Ivashov, head of the Union of Russian Officers, that is a much more fringe organisation than that title may suggest, saying that it will be an absolute disaster and badly thought through. Since then, we have seen other figures talking about the fact that a major incursion into Ukraine would be a tough fight. There's chatter on various more arcane Telegram and similar social media sites about people recognising the scale of the conflict. And then there's also the fact that there's a particular line that is coming from what tend to be quite sort of nationalist, pro-Putin, pro-government pundits, who are saying essentially that the United States is trying to prod Russia into what would be a disastrous and counterproductive conflict. Now, they are advancing it in the sense of this is the evidence of the kind of malign Western subversion, manipulation and general гибридная война that we face. But I wonder, I'm just wondering, and this may be just simple wishful thinking, whether or not to an extent this is particularly people who are insiders or inside enough to have a sense that in fact Russia is going to pull the trigger and who are trying to essentially nudge the Kremlin away from that particular policy option. Because let's face it, I mean, first of all, you may well not actually want to make it clear that you do know what's going on. After all, revealing that might be construed as treason. But also, you know, for political reasons, it's very, very bad form to go against the Kremlin. So this could actually be, in some ways, what we could think of almost as a sly attempt to influence Putin by more or less saying, you know, we know the Americans want Russia to go to war, but our political leadership is far too canny to be sucked in by that. Because you can't actually say, excuse me, boss, I think you're about to do something deeply, deeply stupid. And the reason I particularly advance this is because we saw that this was used from time to time within Soviet policy discourse. That, again, one could not openly go against what one felt was the Gestalt view of the Politburo. But what you could do is seeming, you know, affecting ignorance about actually what decisions had been made, express the view that the Politburo was far too wise and sensible to make that decision. So it's possible, and one can see this as both a positive and a negative sign. Positive in that precisely it shows that even within the apparatus of the state, and particularly the security apparatus, there are those who are definitely, not I would suspect for moral, but for entirely pragmatic reasons, trying to signal their opposition to any major escalation. But it's also negative in that it's one more potential data point suggesting that, in fact, the Kremlin is inclined towards that kind of an escalation. Again, as ever, with all of these things, I will come and use my usual mantra of we'll have to wait and see. Another Ukraine-related point, as I said, I did warn you this is going to be a rather staccato episode, about sanctions and about attempts to influence Russia. Now, we see a very interesting information operation strategy coming out from Washington, this attempt to actually more or less say, this is what we know, this is what we believe is going to happen. And look, although one can and should be very, very cautious about accepting at face value things that we are told that their secret spooky assets have been able to uncover. But nonetheless, it does represent an interesting new type of strategy precisely in order to deter Russia by taking away its, or some of, its capacity to weave a narrative to justify whatever escalation it may have in mind. And also to give some sense of the degree to which its innermost deliberations are open to American scrutiny. But beyond that, unfortunately, we're still at a position in which we have sanctions. Now, there are some who are saying there should be NATO troops being emplaced on Ukraine. Well, I'm not of the view that, in fact, we really want to be risking World War III at this stage. I don't think it would necessarily deter Putin. In a way, it would precisely seem to reinforce his view that, in fact, we've always wanted Ukraine to be some kind of advance base for NATO assets. But on the other hand, I mean, I do think that we need to be thinking more creatively, this is a point I've made in the past, about exactly what we can present as the potential downsides of any kind of escalation over and above whatever happens on the battlefield. And the key thing is, of course, communicate this to Putin in advance. Measures applied after the event have already failed to deter. One thing I was thinking of in terms of trying to think of more asymmetric approaches is this. Look, the European Union clearly has concerns about economic sanctions, which to an extent I can understand. America is very bullish about sanctions that it doesn't ultimately have to pay for. The pain from economic sanctions, particularly anything that involves gas and the like, would clearly massively, disproportionately hit Europe rather than anyone else. So the Europeans have at least some kind of a point there. Well, okay, so what else can they do? In some ways, I think, it's a question of finding other ways of really bringing pressure, pain, frankly, to bear on neuralgic points. Because after all, there's no point threatening things that aren't going to actually affect Putin's calculus in any meaningful way. So instead, one of the things I was thinking of was we really need to look again at Moldova. Now, Moldova is constitutionally neutral, and that's fine, and therefore I don't think we should be doing anything to question or jeopardise that. But on the other hand, this is a small country with a terrible economy, but also a new and dynamic leadership that is clearly very keen to reorient Moldova much more directly towards the West, and which is therefore, as a result, facing quite considerable pressure from the Russians. There is all kinds of shenanigans ranging from pressure coming from the usual point, gas, through to more covert and subversive instruments. Well, maybe then we should be thinking, okay, well, in that case, if you do go into Ukraine, we will move dramatically to shore up Moldova. Because remember, it's a question of whether when you have poverty, when you have marginalized communities, when you have deeply fractious politics, which in itself is often actually a byproduct of poverty, that creates all kinds of opportunities for Russian political warfare. Well, then maybe we should do something about it. And just to give you a sense, the GDP of Moldova is less than 11 billion euros. If one looks at the European Union security and defence budget spending, I mean, just that line item on the European Union budget, and that doesn't mean all the European Union states, I'm just talking about the Central European Union budget and apparat, is more than that. So, you know, we could be in a position where, for example, we could try and find creative ways to reorient Moldova's energy requirements, so that in fact it's being supplied from the West rather than from the East, and so that Russia loses that particular leverage. Russia is claiming that there is a sort of a huge debt to be paid. However difficult it might seem to think of giving Russians money as a way of actually delivering a political blow to Moscow, but maybe even that, pay off the debt and in the process lift, again, one of the sort of pressure points that is currently bearing on Moldova. And there's all kinds of things that could be done. But the main thing is this, and I mean, this is just literally, it was a thought that I had while brushing my teeth this morning. It gives an idea of just how preoccupied my thoughts may be. But I'm just simply saying we really do need to be going back to more imaginative notions of how we can actually bring pressure to bear on a country such as Russia. Because at the moment, I think it is clear that economic sanctions, even the massive and unprecedented ones that are currently being threatened, I'm not saying they're irrelevant, but I would say that they clearly do not have the kind of determining impact that we would like to think. So let's think of other things. A final point. Let us think about the deeply, deeply dangerous and worrying scenario that Putin does pull the trigger on a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, presumably, as what we're told, geared towards either taking or encircling Kiev, forcing some kind of new political arrangement on the Ukrainians, or maybe even trying to set up some kind of puppet government, which, let's be honest, will have to be, whatever the Russians may think, will have to be maintained by a massive and aggressive Russian garrison. But okay, if that does happen, what can we learn from that? Well, first of all, it is quite frankly that Putin is indeed every bit as out of touch as we may have feared. That he is being sort of fed a certain perspective on the world by people who are motivated by ideology, by nationalism, by a visceral distaste of the notion that countries that are meant to be within their sphere of influence might actually have sovereignty and agency, and by an even more visceral belief that the West is hostile and is out to get them. But it also means that he will have been either denied or have chosen to ignore information which I cannot believe is not passing his desk. I mean, we know, for example, that every morning he gets three briefing books, one from the Foreign Intelligence Service about what's going on in the outside world, one from the Federal Security Service, the FSB, about what's going on inside the country, and one from the FSO, the Federal Protection Service, essentially Putin's Praetorian Guard, telling him firstly about elite politics and the mood of the elite, and secondly, more broadly, about the mood of the country. You know, the FSO, after all, is behind a massive opinion polling program that rolls 365 days a year. So this polling agents, polling material, cannot help but have reflected the fact that the Russian people are not prepared, willing, or eager for war. Now, let's not pretend that there's necessarily going to be protests if anything does happen. But nonetheless, there is no way that he could not know that there is a degree of resistance within the public, and also a degree of trepidation and resistance from within the elite. He must have chosen to ignore that. So it's not simply that the good Tsar is being led astray by his evil boyars, to go for a classic old trope of how to excuse the Tsar, who, after all, was appointed by God, at a time of particularly unpleasant, repressive, or just simply uncaring rule. Well, no, it's not just that. Putin himself has to be choosing to not pay attention to some of the data that is crossing his desk, because presumably other people are saying things that he finds more alarming or more powerful. So, yeah, the encapsulation will have taken place. And it also must mean that Shoigu, and he will disappoint me of this, and I'm sure that will be a great blow to him, but Shoigu is not communicating reservations that are coming from within the professional military class. So, okay, so we will then know at that point that Putin has officially left planet Earth. In connection with that, a second thing is it will have demonstrated conclusively that something that people were warning about, frankly, without proper grounds from really the beginning of Putin's reign, which is actually that exactly power has shifted to a particularly unpleasant coterie of security service dominating hawks. I'm trying to think, the collective noun of hawks is, I think it's a, one is a kettle, or there's a boil, or I think a cast is the other one. But I like the idea of a boil of hawks being sort of gathered around Putin. We knew, for example, that the business community really didn't have much traction on the policy process by these days, at least not in terms on, when it comes to major foreign policy issues. And that obviously clearly applies to some of the figures within the business community who we thought had personal connections to Putin. But also, I think it must demonstrate surely that people like Mishustin do not really have that much traction, because this any kind of military intervention is going to make Mishustin's job one hell of a lot harder. And much the same will go for Vainov, the head of the presidential administration, and his first deputy and general kind of political wrangler-in-chief, Kirienko. I think these are people who clearly will have realised that they should not, need not, cannot, and must not go against the Silovik ascendancy at this time. So again, I think it will mark the real rise of the ageing and paranoid security elites over the rest of the political system, something that in fact Putin had actually avoided until now. And I think the third, and again, this is actually a very downbeat segment, but frankly, I don't see how it could be anything but in the context. But anyway, I think that the third real lesson to be learned is welcome to Brezhnevism. I think that, any military attack will not lead to the immediate sort of collapse of the Putin system or anything like that, but will lead really to the true rigidification of a new Cold War. Clearly, long-term economic and indeed social isolation of Russia, which I think is an absolute tragedy, because I still feel that one of our best ways of actually damaging Putin is precisely by being as open to the rest of Russian society as possible. But realistically speaking, both from the point of view of the resources available to visa sections and such like, and also a genuine sense of wanting to punish Russia, not just Putin, I think it will mean growing isolation, and that will inevitably mean stagnation within Russia itself. Not quick, not rapid, but then Brezhnevism didn't rapidly degrade. But nonetheless, that kind of trajectory. So really, we will have moved from, shall I say, late Putinism into senescent Putinism. And that's just too miserable. So let's just stop and have a break and talk about other things. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows.
And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galeotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. So, in this segment, I want to tackle one question I got from a listener and then two specific requests for Mystic Mark's predictions. Now, the question was essentially, and this is in the context of the publication of my book, The Weaponization of Everything, which, incidentally, I would mention comes out tomorrow, the 15th of February, in the United States and the rest of the world, and also in audible format with an audiobook narrated by me. There you go, end of the compulsory little plug there. But anyway, in the context of that book and this notion that precisely conflict, even in a day when we're talking about potentially massive invasions of Ukraine, but interstate conflict has in so many ways moved into non-kinetic, non-shooting arenas, how come Russia seems to be so good at playing all these other types of contestation games? And the answer I'll use, I'll start by actually drawing a parallel with how come Russians certainly had, and still to a large extent have, such good hackers. So much so that it's almost become, frankly, a cliche, the Russian hacker. Well, part of the reason for that is a very strong tradition of teaching mathematics, which is obviously very important when you're programming. The other part was, at a time when this was arising, in the 80s and early 90s, the Soviet Union and then Russia was, frankly, pretty poor. So they didn't have the latest computers, they certainly didn't have the latest programs. And so, and again, this is a very much a generalization, but at a time when the West, we were getting quite lazy and relying on programs and wizards and all the other means of hand-holding, the Russians were actually having to learn programming and really do everything from scratch. So they got to understand what was going on under the metaphorical bonnet, actually how the engine worked, rather than just simply driving the car. And although now clearly Russians have access to the same computers and the same programs as the rest of us, it meant that there was also, therefore, something of a kind of a tradition. There was a whole subculture of hackers. Not necessarily, if we think of hackers, we think of people trying to break into bank accounts or whatever, not necessarily in a negative way, but just simply exploring quite what they could do online. And a multi-generational process that occurred in that you had the earlier generations who, in some ways, take on apprentices and share their knowledge. So three things there. Mathematics, a need to learn the inner workings rather than just the outer controls of how to use a computer, and also this generational dimension. Well, if we move that to this whole kind of issue of what we could actually think of as hacking the international system, well, on the one hand, the Soviets and the Russians were prey to a very, I would suggest, intellectual approach to conflict, thinking about it within the military, but also within the security establishment and so forth, and thinking in terms of theories and mechanisms and models in a much more kind of scientific world outlook than, frankly, we generally have in the West. So that's equivalent to, the mathematics. Secondly, and most crucially, we have a country that can't simply be dismissed as a regional power, let alone a gas station with nukes or some other trite little put-down that you might get in the political circles. But on the other hand, is facing a world in which it is no longer a really heavy hitter. It doesn't have the economic power, the technological prowess, the soft power of its notional rival, the United States, and sort of the European Union and China. And therefore, it has had to turn to alternative means of asserting its power. So again, it has not been able to remain fat and lazy on the basis of its existing methods of projecting its power. It's had to look for new ways of doing it, which is equivalent to precisely going back to the original programming and trying to think, well, actually, what really has an impact? And then the final point, the equivalent of this sort of cultural and generational thing, is precisely the extent to which we see so much of the thinking, planning, and even organization of the current political warfare operations as building on the backs of the old KGB's notions of active measures. This sense that precisely you had a whole, not just a toolbox of practical things you can do, but a whole way of looking at the world and looking at the way you influence politics and do so through covert means, which has been very much modernised and updated and has meant that a lot of the old ideas can just simply then be fed to a new generation so that, you know, old veterans of the KGB who understand active measures can pass that on to a new generation of tech and media savvy, entrepreneurial, whatever you want to call them, political warriors, shall we say, and they can fuse their own current skills with the knowledge that they have learned from their seniors. So I think this is in many ways how, you know, one can draw that parallel, because as I said, in many ways what Russia is doing is hacking the international system. Okay, so two specific questions I was asked to make my predictions for 2022, even though 2022 is proving really quite a difficult year to look through to December. Anyway, first one is, will Russia remain in Syria through the course of this year? And my answer is almost certainly yes. The war is not won, even though the blunt truth of the matter is that Damascus really is winning, except in the areas where essentially the Turks are holding sway, right in the north. The only reason one could think of for the Russians to withdraw from Syria, bar some kind of absolute black swan event like a sudden coup d'etat in Damascus or somewhere, which I don't think is going to happen, is actually if Ukraine escalates to the point that that begins to cause a significant challenge to their capacity to rotate their personnel and continue resupply. And again, it would be very hard to sort of chart through to this, but something like, let's say, if the Turks did close the Bosphorus to Russian ships, which clearly provides the lion's share of munitions and the like, and there were other issues with their sending planes to Syria. So there might be a sort of an enforced evacuation in that case. I think it really is unlikely that things are going to get to that kind of a pitch. And assuming it doesn't, then I see, frankly, very little reason for the Russians to pull out. The war will not be over in the course of this year. But meanwhile, they're getting first-rate experience. They're getting a chance to blood their pilots. I mean, majority of Russian combat pilots have now served a tour in Syria. They're getting a chance to test and show off their various forms of kit, and they're just demonstrating that they are serious players as international security guarantors. So this is one reason why it's worth being under Russia's wing. So are they going to stay in Syria to the end of the year? Yes. And the second and last question is, will FSB director Alexander Bortnikov stay on through the course of the year? And I'm going to say no. I mean, first of all, look, he's 70 years old. And again, that in and of itself is not necessarily an impediment. We have others such as Nikolai Patrushev, Secretary of the Security Council, and indeed his successor and patron, sorry, predecessor and patron, who, you know, are 70 and show absolutely no signs of slowing down or anything like that. On the other hand, I mean, there is talk that Bortnikov is ill. It's worth noting that he missed the first three Security Council sessions of the year. And although, you know, to miss one is not that unusual, to miss two even, one of those three was on border management issues, which really is an issue in which the FSB would have been expected to actually have had an opinion. And three in a row, that was unlikely. Now, he did turn up for the fourth one. But again, people who, you know, have looked at it suggest that he looked a bit pale and so forth. The issue is that there is anointed successor, let's say three-quarters anointed successor, First Deputy Director Karalyov. Karalyov, whom I profiled in a previous podcast, if people are interested, I'll put a link in the program notes. He is smart and able and ruthless and frankly scary. On the other hand, particularly from his time as director of the Economic Security Department, he has also made some really quite significant enemies, both within the FSB and, more importantly, without. And I get the sense that there is something of a Stop Korolyov campaign. And also a claim that he hasn't really been in position as a deputy director for long enough. So it could well be that Bortnikov is having to stay on, even though there is a sort of a probable successor, while, well, firstly, either just Korolyov just spends a little bit more time as first deputy director, just to sort of show that he can handle the job, but also while they try to resolve the political disputes over his elevation, or maybe even until they can actually find another candidate who is more generally acceptable, will be less politically problematic to a point. So, I mean, I think he's stuck in the job just as long as it takes to find that suitable successor. But I would be surprised if they couldn't find something or just steamroll over the resistance in the course of this year. So my view is that by the end of 2022, Bortnikov will be out. And as I promised, all of these predictions I will return to at the end of the year or the start of the next year. And where I'm proven to be wrong, I will talk about and think about quite why I was wrong. But anyway, as I said, this was going to be just a short podcast just to cover a few issues and also just to reassure people that I haven't entirely disappeared. It's more just, you know, it's hard not to talk about Ukraine. But in reality, we talk a lot about Ukraine, but really this is just filling space. We don't really know all that much, and we just simply talk because, well, hey, that's what pundits do. So I won't waste any more of your time and wish you a very, very fine Valentine's Day and talk to you soon.
Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. И только будь, пожалуйста, со мной.